Welcome to The End of Innocence, the JFK assassination. I'm your host, John Young. Over the past several weeks, we've been breaking down the murder of Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit on November 22, 1963. Some researchers have called the murder of J.D. Tippit the key to solving the Kennedy assassination. It has been said that if Oswald murdered Tippit, then surely he killed JFK too. That is just total nonsense. But I will tell you this. There was much more going on at the corner of 10th and Patton in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas that day than we were ever told. Let's briefly cover what we have looked at in parts 1 through 4 of our episodes covering J.D. Tippit's murder. I would suggest if you've not listened to those episodes, you go back and listen before moving on in our series. In part 1 of this series, we looked at why Officer Tippit was patrolling Oak Cliff after the assassination, and why some of his unexplainable movements that day are very confusing and add to the mystery of this event that changed American history. What's up with the phone call Tippit made at Top 10 Records about 10 minutes before he was shot? And maybe the biggest question of all, just moments before his own death, why did J.D. Tippit in his patrol car cut off insurance salesman James Andrews and search the back seat of his car without saying a word to Andrews? What or who was he looking for? In part 2, we looked at first-hand accounts from those who witnessed the moments surrounding Officer J.D. Tippit's tragic death. We looked at what eyewitnesses said about the shooter, and what those witnesses said exactly happened during the brief and fatal encounter between Tippit and his killer. And perhaps most importantly, we heard if any of those witnesses actually identified Lee Harvey Oswald as the gunman. In part 3 of our series, we looked at exonerating or at least compelling evidence that cast serious doubt on Oswald's guilt in the Tippit shooting. Why could witnesses not agree what the killer of J.D. Tippit was wearing? We heard allegations by Aquila Clemens and Frank Wright that two men were involved in killing Tippit. And we also looked at why one of those important witnesses, Aquila Clemens, disappeared and was never heard from again. We looked at possibly what the story of the shells found at the Tippit murder scene tells us. And did the shells found at the scene match the bullets found in Tippit's body? The answer may surprise you. In last week's episode, we looked at another disputed area in this case, and that is the discovery of the light gray zip-up jacket that supposedly belonged to Lee Harvey Oswald and was worn by him at the time of the Tippit shooting. Also, we looked at the mystery of Oswald's wallets. One found at Ruth Payne's house, one found at the Tippit murder scene, and yet another wallet found on Oswald after his arrest. Also, witness to the J.D. Tippit shooting, Helen Markham, told the police that Tippit's killer leaned on the ledge of the car window on the passenger side door just a few seconds before shooting Tippit. Was Lee Harvey Oswald's prints found on that door? We discussed that in last week's episode. One of the strongest arguments against Lee Harvey Oswald being the killer of Officer J.D. Tippit is the timeline. It simply doesn't add up when you examine Oswald's documented movements. To assess this, we need to answer three key questions. What time did Oswald leave his rooming house? What time was Tippit shot? How long would it have taken Lee Harvey Oswald to walk from his rooming house to the crime scene? The murder of Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit is often cited as proof of Lee Harvey Oswald's guilt in the JFK assassination, but a closer look at the timeline raises serious doubts. If Oswald left his rooming house at 1:05 p.m. and Tippit was shot as early as 1:06, the math doesn't work. Witnesses who checked the time, Margie Higgins, Helen Markham, and T.F. Bally, placed the shooting well before the Warren Commission official estimate of 1:15 p.m., and no one saw Oswald walking the nearly mile-long route to the crime scene. The question remains, if Oswald couldn't have made it in time, how could he have committed the crime? According to the Warren report, Lee Harvey Oswald left the Texas School Book Depository building and took a bus, and then a cab driven by William Whaley, who dropped him off near his rooming house at 1026 North Beckley Avenue.
By this time, most of Dallas, most of the United States, knew of the tragedy that had struck the motorcade and had begun to fear how great a tragedy it was. Oswald entered a cab.
Well, he just looked like an ordinary working man. He was small, had on gray work clothes, brown shirt and a silver stripe and a work jacket. He said he got in, said he wanted to go to 500 block North Beckley.
What did you talk to him about as you came around here?
Well, I didn't talk very much. I didn't know the president was shot at that time, and the police cars and sirens were running all around this end of town, making a lot of noise. So all I said to him was, I wonder what the hell all the commotion is in this end of town. He didn't answer me. So I didn't say any more to him. I figured he was one of these people that didn't want to talk. He had something else on his mind.
Mr. Whaley, when you went up to the Warren Commission, what were they more interested in than anything else? Any particular area of your testimony?
Well, yes, sir, in the time element and what I put out on my sheet. They wanted to know why I approximated my time, and I explained to them that I put the trip down as every 15 minutes.
Now, he lived right here in this block.
Right here, in the same block, right here, 1018.
Which, from the house right there?
That house right there, sir.
But he didn't say anything about getting out.
No, sir, and he wasn't looking at it as we passed. And about along right in here, he asked me, he just said, this will do fine right here. But the cars were parked like this, and I waited till I passed the last car and pulled over to the curb, which was the intersection of Neely and North Beckley.
And did you tell him how much the fare was, or what?
No, sir, I didn't. He just looked at the meter, and it was 95 cents. He handed me a dollar, opened the door and got out, walked around in front of the cab and crossed the street, and that's the last I saw him. I went on about my business.
Oswald had gone about four blocks past his boarding house. Now he began walking back. Dallas police already were broadcasting a description of their suspect.
Oswald arrived around 1 p.m., and according to housekeeper Earlene Roberts, stayed no more than 3 or 4 minutes. Roberts noted that Oswald entered in a hurry. He was still nearby moments later when she looked out the window. In her affidavit, she stated, quote, Oswald went out the front door. A moment later, I looked out the window. I saw Lee Oswald standing on the curb at the bus stop. I just glanced out the window that once. I don't know how long Lee Oswald stood at the curb, nor did I see which direction he went when he left there, end quote. This raises a serious contradiction. Robert saw Oswald waiting at the bus stop, located one house north of the rooming house, heading in the opposite direction of the Tippit shooting scene, which was to the south. Was Oswald planning to take a bus north? Did he change his mind and walk south instead? Or was he waiting for someone to pick him up?
Well, when I got the telephone call about Aunt Preston being killed, I walked over here and turned the television on.
I was watching As the World Turns. It comes on from 12:30 to 1. And they'd been on a few minutes, and they says a special bulletin.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
Well, I was listening, had the television on, listening, trying to find out what happened to President Kennedy when he came in. It must have been after 1 o'clock, because he come in and...
Now, who are you in a hurry? He never parted his lips and went to his room, got a short coat and put on, and went out and to the bus stop. And that's the last I saw of him.
Earlene Roberts told the FBI that Oswald left the house a couple minutes after 1 p.m., while zipping up his dark-colored jacket. Again, a dark-colored jacket. The distance from the rooming house to the Tippit murder scene was 0.9 mile. The FBI knew it was not possible for Oswald to have left the rooming house at 1:04 to 1:05 p.m. and walked 0.9 to 10th and Patton in 4 to 5 minutes. This created a big problem, because the FBI now realized that Lee Harvey Oswald could not have shot Officer J.D. Tippit. Based on Whaley and Robert's testimony, Oswald could not have left the rooming house earlier than 1:04 to 1:05 p.m.
And the timeline that they have to put together, the Warren Commission, is the entire crazy pretzel logic of trying to construct a timeline for Oswald of every waking minute of that day. And when they don't have a timeline, they have to monkey around with the time of death to make it fit into Oswald's timeline, because we know that Oswald was back at his rooming house at 1 o'clock. We know that because the housekeeper was watching CBS News, Days of Our Lives, that's interrupted by a CBS News bulletin. We know the time of the bulletin. We know what time Oswald shows up. The situation at the rooming house, where Earlene Roberts, the housekeeper, sees him, that's kind of like a touchstone, because that's like she sees him get into his coat. She sees him leave. She sees him go to the bus stop across the street, and it's like 1:04. So we know what time Oswald gets to the rooming house. We know what time he's across the street, and we know that he's going to get to the Texas Theater.
The Warren report claims that Tippit was shot around 1:15 p.m. However, critics cite witness testimony suggesting the shooting occurred earlier. Helen Markham said the shooting happened at 1:06 or 1:07 p.m. She was heading to catch a bus scheduled to arrive at 1:12 p.m., not 1:15, as she initially told the Warren Commission. If the shooting occurred at 1:15, she would have already been on the bus. Margie Higgins, who lived nearby, told reporters she checked her TV clock immediately after hearing gunshots. It read 1:06 p.m. T.F. Bally chanced on the post-event murder scene at 1:10 p.m. and announced the crime on Tippit's own car radio. Domingo Benavides, who witnessed the shooting, tried to use Tippit's car radio to call in the shooting, but couldn't figure out how to use the radio. That's when Bally stepped in and made the call. At 1:10 p.m., the police dispatcher received a message, quote, 602 code 5. 602 was the number assigned by the Dallas police to the Dudley Hughes ambulance, and code 5 meant the ambulance was en route to 10th and Patton. Seconds later, at 1:10 p.m., the dispatcher received another message, quote, 603 code 5. 603 was the number assigned to the ambulance from Baylor, and code 5 meant that the ambulance was en route to 10th and Patton. And once again, at 1:10 p.m., the dispatcher received the message, quote, 605 code 5, which was the number assigned to ambulances from the Veterans Administration, and code 5 meant that the ambulance was en route to 10th and Patton. All contact between the dispatchers and the three ambulances were recorded at 1:10 p.m. by the Dicta Belt machine on Channel 1. Therefore, the shooting of Officer Tippit had to have occurred several minutes before 1:10 p.m. After Bally's brief contact with the police dispatcher at 1:10 p.m., the Dudley Hughes ambulance arrived. Driver Jason Butler removed a dark blue jacket from Tippit's body, and together with Bally, loaded Tippit's body into the ambulance. The ambulance, which Jason Butler said was on site for only 1 minute, then hurried to Methodist Hospital, where Tippit was taken to the emergency room for examination. Tippit was pronounced dead by Dr. LeCour at 1:15 p.m. Yes, he is pronounced dead at the hospital at 1:15 p.m., which was the exact time that the Warren Commission said he was being shot. We can now begin to understand the importance and significance of 1:08 p.m. and 1:10 p.m., as recorded by the Dallas Police Desk and transcripts on Channel 1, as they relate to the time of the Tippit murder. Tippit was shot around 1:06 p.m., a couple of minutes before Benavidez got out of his pickup, walked to the Tippett's patrol car, and tried to contact the police dispatcher at 1:08 p.m. At this same time, or a couple minutes earlier, Lee Oswald had just left his rooming house. So could Oswald have made the walk? The distance from Oswald's rooming house to the crime scene at 10th and Patton is about 9/10 of a mile. The Warren report claims, quote, if Oswald left shortly after 1 p.m. and walked briskly, he would have reached the scene shortly after 1:15 p.m., end quote. Commission counsel David Bellin timed the walk. It took 17 minutes and 45 seconds. If Oswald left at 1:05 p.m., and Tippett was shot between 1:06 and 1:10 p.m., Oswald would only have a couple minutes to cover the distance. That will require running at a pace of about 15 miles an hour, which is highly unlikely. And if Markham and Higgins are correct that the shooting occurred at 1:06, it would be physically impossible for Oswald to have arrived in time. Even at a brisk pace, it would take 12 to 17 minutes to walk, yet no witnesses reported seeing Oswald during that critical window. This absence is striking. Oak Cliff was a residential area with people out and about. If Oswald had sprinted through the neighborhood, someone likely would have noticed. But this record is silent. Ultimately, the question hinges on what time Tippett was shot. The only witnesses who checked the time immediately after hearing gunshots, Markham, Higgins, and Bally, all suggest a time earlier than 1:15 p.m. If their accounts are accurate, Oswald could not have made it to the scene in time. And once again, the ambulance driver delivered Tippett's body to Beckley Methodist Hospital, where he was declared dead on arrival by a doctor at 1:15 p.m. That's a part of this story that keeps getting overlooked.
Now, the shooting is anywhere from 1:05, 1:06. He put it this way. He's dead at the hospital at 1:15. He's dead at the hospital. So that whatever happened, he's at the hospital. And they originally wrote 1:07 on the death certificate, and they typed over that 1:15. So everybody is monkeying around, Dallas police, FBI, with this timeline, trying to get Oswald from his rooming house to the shooting and then get him to the theater and figure this whole thing out. And no matter how many times they jigger this thing, it doesn't work out. And in here lies an incredible amount of corruption and framing of Oswald. Keep in mind, this is literally 30 minutes after the assassination. The assassination is 12:35, right? At 1 o'clock, he's in his rooming house. At 1:15, Tippett is dead. Think about what you just did for the past 45 minutes of your life. Imagine, imagine you're shooting the president, you come down six flights of stairs, you live about 5 miles away, somehow you get home with a multitude of buses and all this traffic with cars.
He also casually bought like a Coke and some other stuff.
The Coke, he drinks it down, he's seen by the motorcycle cop and the manager of the building, he's calm as a cucumber, he leaves the building and somehow gets home at 1 o'clock and puts on his coat, may or may not have taken his gun. That's kind of debatable also. And ends up going 30 minutes later, he ends up at the Texas Theater. That's what we do know, that he does end up there at 1:30. So he leaves at 1 o'clock. If you just take his angle on this, he leaves at 1 o'clock, ends up at the movie theater at 1:30 where Butch Burrows, who's the manager of the movie theater, is selling popcorn and is futzing around, and Oswald doesn't see anybody there and goes in. He's got plenty of money on him, and maybe he's supposed to meet somebody there. Maybe he's just going to see the movie. I don't really know. You know, and he sits in the back. But that's his timeline, his personal timeline. What they're trying to do is have him literally walk fast, because if he was jogging, so many people would have seen him running through the streets for a mile. That would have been insane. So they walk. Everyone who's tried this cannot do it over the years. Everyone has tried to walk this distance in 4 minutes, 5 minutes, 6 minutes, couldn't pull it off.
This timeline is not a trivial detail. It's central to Oswald's guilt or innocence. If Tippit was shot at 1:06 p.m., Oswald couldn't have done it. To believe he did, you must dismiss multiple eyewitnesses and rely on a timeline that's not plausible. The Tippit shooting is often cited as a second crime that proves Oswald's guilt. If he killed a police officer while fleeing, it reinforces the image of a desperate assassin on the run. But if the timeline doesn't hold, then the foundation of that image crumbles. Was Oswald framed? Was Tippit's murder unrelated? Or was the timeline simply misreported in the chaos of that day? These questions remain unanswered, but one thing is clear. The Tippit timeline deserves more scrutiny than it's received. So far, we've encountered a mix of compelling evidence and puzzling anomalies in the case against Lee Harvey Oswald. There's strong incriminating material, but also strange details, like the honking police car outside Oswald's rooming house, and Officer Tippett's unusual behavior before his death that raises more questions than answers. Add to that the timing evidence that seems to exonerate Oswald, and you're left with a case that's anything but straightforward. For those approaching the JFK assassination with an open mind, it's a maze of contradictions, especially if you haven't already pledged alliance to either the lone gunman theory or the conspiracy camp. One of the most pressing questions for conspiracy theorists is, if Oswald didn't kill J.D. Tippit, then who did? It's worth noting that three Dallas police officers are frequently named in conspiracy circles as having potential involvement in Tippit's murder: Harry Olson, William Westbrook, and Kenneth Croy. We'll look at them next week. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the release of the JFK assassination records, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. I can promise you, you won't be disappointed in the book. It's an oversized coffee table style book. The book is over 500 pages with almost 1,000 pictures. You won't be disappointed. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com.